Welcome to EIR Talks. On May 28, 2002, Democratic Party presidential pre-candidate Lyndon H. LaRouche held an international webcast entitled How to Win the Peace before a live audience in Washington, D.C., speaking from Germany. This week, we bring you the first part of his opening remarks to the worldwide audience.
On behalf of Lyndon LaRouche's campaign for the Democratic nomination for the presidency, and of course on behalf of Executive Intelligence Review, I'd like to welcome you to today's webcast. As I think you may know, this is the second in a series of addresses to a Washington, D.C. audience by Mr. LaRouche. It is something that has come very quickly on the heels of his May 1st address. But in fact, the combination of the response to that May 1st address and also the reality of the global situation and of the global crisis has in fact necessitated this second address. I think that for anyone who has even the most remote grip on reality, the simple fact is that anyone's ability to deny the fact that we are right now functioning without an operable financial system is something which is apparent. And for many people in a policymaking position, both inside and outside the United States, the fact that they should have listened to Lyndon LaRouche is now an inescapable reality. The only question that remains is whether or not these various individuals will find the combination of moral and intellectual courage to take action now while there is still time to do so. And now, ladies and gentlemen, really without any further delay, I'd like to introduce Mr. Lyndon LaRouche.
In these times, I'd like to speak on the question of the lessons to be learned from looking at the human side, the human experience of war. And despite the fact that the Congress has monkeyed so much with the date of Memorial Day, let us consider this Memorial Day week and let us celebrate it accordingly. Now let me begin with the question of where do you find in yourself not only the courage to conduct war, to participate in war when necessary, but where do you find in yourself those qualities which enable you to look beyond the short term of next week or your immediate community and find that strength you need to think and act on the basis of what the consequences of your behavior will be, perhaps for the next generation or two yet to come? We need that kind of courage today, that kind of intellect among our own citizens, so they can begin to think clearly in the way that the present crisis demands of us, to think clearly as a similar but different challenge was presented to people who fought and died in two wars in the last century, the two mate world wars of the last century. To find that source of strength, I ask you to look inside yourself and look at your history of your family, what you know of your family, and what you know of something about the nation beyond your immediate family. And think about the fact that you live and you die as the people before you did. And you think about not only what you're getting out of living now, but you're thinking about how you look, how the way you behave, how the way you respond to the present crisis looks in the eyes of those who died and who cannot act anymore, but are looking at you within your own mind and say, are you capable of doing what needs to be done as we did in ours? Now, in my own case, to start with my own case, as a help perhaps for you to look at your own, I go back about 200 years. That is in terms of my experience in my family. My parents were born in the 1890s. My grandparents were born in the 1860s. At our family table of the family, we went back with one character who's a great-great-grandfather, who was rather famous in his time. He was a leader of the abolitionist movement and got into some trouble on that account. And he was rather famous, and he kept appearing at the family dinner table. What he said on such and such occasion was remembered and spoken of again and again. And every family has something like that. My history goes back 200 years. Now, in terms of the family history in the nation, it goes back further. My first ancestors came respectively to North America from France and England in the about the 1670s. Some to Pennsylvania, some to Quebec. Other ancestors came from Scotland and Ireland in the 1860s. One as a Scottish soldier, great-grandfather was a Scottish soldier, a professional saberman who came over to join the Civil War in the 1st Royal Albert Cavalry. His brother was a famous sea captain for the White Star Line. And in the same group, we had some Irish who came in, and Condons and whatnot from Ireland, and they came in at about the same time. We also had on the French side from Quebec a certain trace of American Indian ancestry. So if I go on the warpath once in a while, you'll understand why. But such is the nature. So that we all have our own particular type of roots in our own family history and in this nation, and in our own nation if it's a different one. And we think of ourselves as mortal beings who live for a time within a succession of families and within a nation. We think of ourselves as worth being remembered. We remember those who went before us, and their faces are still in our mind as part of their conscience. And that generally is the model for the healthy development of any child or young person in society. The family, neighborhood grouping, the roots of the family back two, three, or more generations, a sense of where the family came from and where the nation came from, what was important to those who went before us, these kinds of things. So instead of thinking about what makes us feel good today, we say, what will make us feel good when we're dead? What can we go to our grave thinking we did that was good? That we did something necessary? That we had the courage to do something necessary? We all die sooner or later. And that essentially is our history. But other people die in war. And there's a slight difference between dying in general and dying in war. And I think it's appropriate to think about that comparison today, that we are all in a similar situation. Some have experienced war, some not. But war is a part of the experience, and many people in the United States died in the course of two world wars. For example, we talk of heroes who died in battle. But most people who died in war did not die in battle. They died in what Clausewitz in his writings called friction. Jeep accidents. Illnesses. For example, in my experience, there was an area in northern Burma in which soldiers in that area ran into a disease called generically bush typhus, or in Japanese, tsukamushi, which Japanese soldiers had brought into that area from other parts of Asia. And at that time, we had no cure for it. So these soldiers, many of whom I saw dying, were simply lying in a hospital barracks, quietly dying, with no cure in sight. They did not return home to their families. There was a case in one ward in the same hospital, in which there were three people who had died or were dying of a plane accident. I believe the C-46 of the type that was flying from at that time from Mishima to China. They crashed on takeoff. They survived, but they inhaled a lot of kerosene or gasoline, and they were dying of that, the effects of that on their lung system and so forth. They were semi-comatose, moving. And day after day, they'd lay being cared for in beds side by side in the row in that barracks. And across the aisle from them was a fellow of Hispanic background, a Mexican-American, who was dying because he'd been shot by a British MP while visiting a village. And they were there day by day. We watched them, living and dying. And one morning, they were simply gone. They died overnight, all four of them. Jeep accidents and so forth. And that's the way most people who died in war died. Not in battle, but as a result of friction. That was part of our experience. So we had two world wars. And let's look briefly at the two world wars. Let's just take a glimpse of some film clips from motion picture shots made of American soldiers in World War I. And after that, take a look at some shots from Germany during the period that Germany was going into World War II, just to get a sense and a memory of the feel of what this was like. The images are obvious to you. These are just old films from that period. This was the kind of war, but many people died. Now, this image, the soldiers going over the top to charge, over the top to charge, in a machine gun fire, against barbed wire, and so forth. This was a significant part of the American experience. This is one of the ways people died, but they also died in France, not only in the trenches, in trench warfare, they died in frictional incidents as well. But they didn't come back. And there were families that were waiting for them. They never had the chance to receive their return. And that's also part of the American experience. This went on, again, the German phenomenon, the march to war. You see the mobilization, the march to war. It worries you because you see people like that, marching to war. You think what goes on in their minds as they do that. You see the horrors of Nazi Germany with the SS troops marching, the other troops marching, marching to war, a war which would end up with the virtual destruction of Germany, marching to war. And that was just the German side in World War II. Look at the case of the war in Asia. In order to get to learn a lesson, the MacArthur was a great general, probably one of the greatest in American history. He did the most for the United States as a commander. He fought a war in the Pacific under what seemed to be desperate circumstances. He brought it to a successful conclusion, even before Hiroshima. He fought a couple of heavy battles, or ordered a couple of heavy battles, serious ones, major ones, bloody slugfests. But he fought no unnecessary battles. He moved past islands occupied by Japanese troops and didn't attempt to get them out of there. Why waste lives? Taking islands, we have them isolated. We control the seas. We control the air around them. Why bother? We'll come back later. No need to fight a war on those beaches. No need to go into those islands. So MacArthur had a sense of economy of war. MacArthur was not fighting war to kill people. The object of the American soldier in World War II was not to kill people. Maybe some people had that idea. It wasn't killing. The purpose of war fighting was to win the war. The purpose was to win the peace, not to kill everybody you wish to hate. But to win. To win what? To win war. What's war? Winning the peace. That was MacArthur's policy. We didn't need to invade Japan. We never needed to invade Japan. And my opinion is MacArthur never intended to. Certainly MacArthur is the kind of general who would never have done a silly thing like dropping nuclear weapons on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Why didn't we need to invade Japan? Why is the myth that we needed to invade Japan told? It's a big lie. Japan is a country which is an island country without adequate raw materials and similar resources in its own territory to sustain its own economy. Japan lives as an economy, as a modern economy, by imports from other parts of the world, including Asia. Therefore, the American strategy, the MacArthur strategy for the Pacific War during World War II was not to kill Japanese. The American strategy was to bring Japan to surrender, to peaceful surrender. By what? By building a net, a blockade net, a naval and aerial blockade, which would prevent Japan from getting the materials it needed to maintain its economy and therefore its war machine. It was also known during that time, which many of you may not know, that the Emperor of Japan, in the course of early 1945, had entered into diplomatic negotiations for peace. His channel for negotiations was the Vatican. It was the office of a Cardinal Montini, who was later Pope Paul VI. And some friends of mine were involved in those negotiations at that time. So the United States knew it had an offer of negotiation of peace from the Emperor of Japan. Why should we invade Japan? Why didn't the peace come? Well, partly because the British and Americans didn't want it to come after Roosevelt was dead. Partly because some people wanted vengeance, not peace. But MacArthur and others understood that well, the problem that the emperor had, the emperor wanted peace, but he had some generals who didn't want to surrender. And therefore the U.S. policy was to squeeze, maintain a tight blockade, aerial and naval blockade, which is almost totally effective. And Japan would have to surrender. And the generals would have to bend their knee to the will of the emperor, and peace would come. In point of fact, the peace that did come after Hiroshima and Nagasaki were the same peace which the emperor had negotiated through the Vatican channels before then. So there was never a need for U.S. troops to have a forced invasion of those islands of Japan. MacArthur was not out to kill Japanese. MacArthur was out to win war by using the strategic logistical might of the United States mobilized to bring about a condition in which the Japanese people and institutions would accept peace as the alternative to war. That was the way we used to fight wars. Now, there's a principle involved, and you may see smell what I'm getting at here about present military policies, which frankly are immoral and insane. And I would hope that our country would stop it, because this is stupid, immoral, insane. We used to have a different military policy. Before they got rid of MacArthur, and before Eisenhower retired as president, we used to have a different kind of military tradition in the United States, different than what we have today, different than what was shown in Vietnam, different than what is being shown right now. What was that policy? The policy was developed in the 18th century, and there are two figures from the 18th century who are most important for anyone who wants to understand this to study today. One was the greatest military genius of France, not Napoleon, who was somewhat of a bandit more than a military genius, but a major general, Lazare Carnot, who was also a famous scientist. Lazare Carnot was already a military genius, was given the command of the French forces in 1792. At that point, France was being invaded by every army in Europe. The intent of those armies was to cut France up into individual pieces and chop it up. Lazare Carnot was given the command, a hopeless command, at that point. He turned a hopeless command into a total victory within 2 years. He reformed the armies of France. He made a scientific mobilization of the type that Franklin Roosevelt probably knew about and would have been happy to imitate. And France's military forces on the land continent of Europe became invincible. Every invading army was defeated. France's integrity was defended. Unfortunately, Napoleon spoiled the whole show later on. In the same period, there was another leading military figure in Germany, Gerhard Scharnhorst. Scharnhorst was a product of an education given to him at the school of a famous fellow villain, Schaumburg Lippe. The school, the educational program of the school, was provided by one of the great geniuses of the 18th century, Moses Mendelssohn, the famous Moses Mendelssohn, who designed the program of teaching at the military school, which produced one of the greatest military minds of Germany, Gerhard Scharnhorst. The same group in Scharnhorst had faced with this the point that Napoleon was sending a grand army, which is sort of like the predecessor of the Hitler-Waffen-SS, into Russia, that the German Prussians, influenced by Scharnhorst, developed a plan which is based on some work by a fellow who is a cousin or in-law cousin of Friedrich Schiller. And on the basis of study of Schiller's history of the Netherlands War and the Thirty Years' War, the Prussian command devised a program which they presented to the Tsar of Russia, a policy of strategic defense which resulted in the entrapment and destruction of Napoleon. This concept of strategic defense is consistent with the idea of the citizen army. One of the things that came out of France under Lazare Carnot, what came out of Germany under the influence of Scharnhorst, the idea of the citizen reserve army. We in World War II were not the best fighters in World War II, the Americans. The Germans were much more effective as soldiers than the Americans, soldier for soldier. And this has been studied extensively because they had a training program in depth and a reserve program, which is based on the Scharnhorst program. We put together a military force in the United States after years of negligence of the necessary steps to build a standing reserve, effective reserve, and to build a military force that could cope with these kinds of problems. So we went into World War II like a bunch of military slobs, generally. I saw it myself, so I witness testimony. But what we won the war with and what our best commanders understood was to use the economic might, which had been built up again under President Franklin Roosevelt, to give us the logistical and strategic logistical capabilities to win war by logistics. And the United States won war, World War II, with logistics, not with kill power. We don't have logistics today. We have kill power. We don't have a war-winning capability. We have a perpetual war fighting capability until it just quits when it gets tired. And that's the big issue. We emerged from World War II not only as the greatest power on the planet, but the only power on the planet. No other nation represented a power in world terms, just the United States. We had no need to invade Japan. We controlled everything. We controlled their environment. We controlled their skies. We controlled the seas around them. We didn't need to invade. We were prepared, at least some of us, to make peace with Japan. So why should we fight war? Why should we invade? There's a famous fellow, Machiavelli, who most people misunderstand these days, who laid down a policy, a military policy, in his works on the Books of Livy, and pointed out the reasons why you never, when an enemy is defeated, you never go in for the kill, because the enemy may start killing again in desperation. You never close in, bayonet to bayonet or otherwise, on a defeated enemy. What you do is you use the power you have to create the conditions under which the enemy will accept a peaceful solution to the conflict, which is the way we should approach our problems on the world today. We should not be the world policemen, like Roman legions or the Nazi Waffen-SS, running around the world and killing people we say are rogue states, or might have weapons of mass destruction, or might have terrorists among them. That policy is idiocy, is criminality. We knew how to do things better before. Build up two things, a strategic defense in depth, which is largely economic power, physical economic power. Increase the productive powers of labor of your people, as Roosevelt did during the 1930s in the recovery. Build up your educational system. Open plants. Create new productive jobs. Not consumer society jobs, but production society jobs. Farms that function. Machine tool shops that work. Stop being a consumer society, which we've degenerated into, and go back to becoming a producer society. We have the ability in the United States today, as a nation, to establish our security planet-wide, virtually without firing a shot in a military fire in any part of this planet. All we need to do is to learn the lessons of history of the past centuries, including the Roosevelt history, and lay down a plan of reconstruction of a rotting, collapsing world economy, and say we're going to do our part in revising an economy, a form of economy that has failed. Now back to the individual. The individual who must have the courage, the personal courage, to actually exert a command position in warfare. The soldiers go along as long as they trust their officers, the leaders. But it's the commanders who must have the courage which inspires the soldiers in confidence to work with a leader. We need people who are leaders in the true sense, not leaders in the sense of do as I tell you, I'll shoot you, but leaders in whom the people that follow them have confidence, leaders who inspire confidence in their people, not like the politicians we tend to elect nowadays, but actual leaders. And we have some examples of leaders in modern history, at the birth of modern history, for example, in the 15th century. Jeanne d'Arc, a farm girl, who was seized by the commitment, a mission, to force a king who was a no-good king to become a real king of France, and to reestablish France in its dignity as a nation. And she succeeded. But because of betrayal by that very king himself, Jeanne was tortured by the English Inquisition and burned alive after torture by the English Inquisition.
You're listening to EIR Talks. We'll return in a moment with a continuation of Lyndon LaRouche's international webcast of May 28, 2002. Welcome back to EIR Talks. We continue with Lyndon LaRouche's international webcast of May 28, 2002.
She refused to capitulate. And by her refusal to capitulate and accepting the risk of being burned alive, she made possible not only the existence of France as the first modern nation state, that under Louis XI, but inspired circles in the Catholic Church to conduct reforms which we saw in the 15th century Renaissance. She was one of the great, this little peasant girl, who had a sense of a mission in life, who used her life to do a good because it had to be done, inspired people around her, and by her courage, inspired a nation and more than just that nation, to establish the first modern, true modern nation state in Europe, in European civilization. The example of France under Jeanne d'Arc, the example of Louis XI, was used in England to free England from a tyranny known as that of Richard III. and Henry VII of England established in England the second modern nation state on this planet. Now along came an attempt by the enemies of the nation state, the Venetians, to destroy England, to destroy England's character as a nation state. And to do that, they sent agents in New England to corrupt a rather foolish heir of Henry VII, Henry VIII. You know, the usual sexual thing. They had the religious advisor, Zorzi, with marriage counselor. They tormented Henry VIII with the promise of a woman, Anne Boleyn, who was nothing but a prostitute virtually. And the stupid king became corrupt. And England was being destroyed. Now, what killed Thomas More was not the fact that he objected to the divorce of the king to marry Anne Boleyn. What killed him was the fact that he stood against this corruption of what had been accomplished by Henry VII. England had been the second nation state founded. It was being built as a great economy from the rubble that it had been under the previous Plantagenet rule. It was being destroyed. He gave his life on the chopping block in order to inspire people such as William Shakespeare, who is one of his great followers intellectually, and others, to keep alive in England that which the Venetians had attempted to destroy with the case of Henry VIII and others. And it's because of that courage of Thomas More in England, and because of the influence in particular of Shakespeare and people like him and his associates, there was founded in North America, beginning with the Massachusetts Bay Colony in particular, a conception of a new kind of nation-state built on this continent. At a time that Europe was so corrupt, so torn by religious wars, from 1511 to 1648, Europe was torn apart by religious warfare of the type that some people would like to start around the world today. And during that time, people in Europe said, let us go to North America. Let us build the foundations of a new nation in this continent. And the Winthrops and the Mathers in Massachusetts typify that great venture. Then came Penn with Logan, and others came. As things became terrible in Europe, more and more people looked to the North America as a place to build a republic in the legacy of Francis Louis-Onze, the legacy of Jeanne d'Arc, the legacy of Henry VII, the legacy of Thomas More, to build that in this that republic in this nation. And as great Europeans, despairing of the possibility of building a republic in Europe under these conditions, turned in the 18th century to the English colonies in North America, especially to the circles of Benjamin Franklin personally, to assist us in building up the foundations for creating this republic, which is therefore an historic exception in the modern history of mankind. This was the first true republic established in modern mankind, and it was established on the basis of these foundations contributed to us largely by Europe. And without the courage of the people who did it, people like Jeanne d'Arc and Thomas More, this could not have happened. So therefore, the highest standing is not, I'm not recommending to people that they go out and be burned alive or have their heads chopped off. I'm not particularly fond of that sort of entertainment, but some people are. But rather I'm saying that you have to find in yourself some element of the quality of courage, the quality of insight to the future that you leave behind after your mortal life has ended. And say that what I am in the history of mankind is, as I view my parents, grandparents, and great-grandparents, and so forth before me, I view myself as a passing mortal individual. But I want my life, while it's going on, to mean something. And therefore, I will spend my life wisely. If I have to die on the battlefield, I will spend my life wisely. for a meaningful purpose for my nation and for mankind. Now, people who think that way and can find their roots in family and history and also in the future that way have the courage to face gladly the kind of challenges which we as a nation face today. And one would wish that as I speak, that those who died or whose families made the sacrifice of their death during two world wars of the past century could be with us today to hear me say this and to see you hear this, that they might believe that in this nation there's something that still lives that made their sacrifice worthwhile. And there's the source from which you find the strength, but also you find another source you have to call upon. It's called ideas. Some people believe that what's important is what they know from experience of sense perception, what I can see, what I can taste, what I can touch, what I feel in my neighborhood, my community, my personal immediate physical sense of self-interest. Some people think that way. That's a foolish way of thinking, because you don't understand then the difference between man and animal. Think of all the people you know who say that mankind is just another monkey or just another ape. Now, I admit that we've elected some politicians who might lend themselves to that view. But man is not an ape. Man has a quality which no animal has. Look, if man were a higher ape, whether on high stuff or not, the human species in the past 2 million years would never have reached a level above several million individuals, as the apes did. We now have billions of people. How do we get billions of people out of a being which, as an ape, is only capable of maintaining a miserable bunch of monkeys, so to speak, and about a few million numbers planet-wide? How do we get that? Because mankind has a quality which no monkey has. So don't monkey around with mankind. Mankind is capable of discovering universal principles which cannot be smelled, tasted, seen with the senses, but which the mind is able to define and we're able to prove experimentally. This is what we mean when we say in Christianity, Islam, or Judaism that man and woman are made equally in the image of the Creator of the universe. Because we each have within us that power to discover truth, the truth of universal principles, which no monkey, no lower form of life can do. And through this power, we are able to change man's relations with nature. We're able to change ourselves, to improve and develop ourselves. We're able to transmit these discoveries to our children over successive generations. We're able to build societies where there were nothing but jungles. This is why man is sacred. This is why every human life is special and sacred. This is why every human being, man or woman, is equal in this quality, which need but be developed and expressed. What gives you the power to deal with great crises is to recognize that, to think in terms of principles that you can discover and prove. As Kepler discovered the law of gravity, the universal gravitation, in a book he published in 1609. You can discover these principles, you say, then if I can learn an idea, rediscover an idea, or contribute a new discovery of principle, and if I can pass along these discoveries, which I've taken in part from people before me, if I can pass them to the next generation, if I can enrich these discoveries with something I contribute myself, then I live forever as a human being. Because in the time I occupied mortal life, I picked up the heritage of ideas from the culture, people before me. I picked it up from other cultures than my own. I put these together in part. I transmitted these to young people, as good teachers transmit these discoveries to children. And when I die, these ideas, which I've helped to make possible, these achievements will be transmitted to those who come after me. And therefore, the greatest thing about being human is to be truly a person who acts in a way which justifies the characterization of a being, man and woman, equally made in the image of the creator of the universe, given the power to transform this universe, capable of transmitting these discoveries from one generation to another, to build the human race from its initial imperfection as a beast-like creature with this quality into something much better. And therefore, if I can do something with my life which helps that process, then my life really means something. And I can go out of this life wearing a smile, because I have won. I have won the battle for the meaning of a personal life. Therefore, when it comes to war, or things like war, the person on the other side is a human being, made in the image of the creator of the universe as we are, of the same nature and the same true fundamental interest if they but know it. Therefore, the function of war is to defend this heritage, this cultural heritage that we have been given, but to invite others to share it with us. Invite them to enter into fraternity with us and say, stop being a fool. We will defend. If you go crazy like a madman and do something evil, we're going to stop you if we have to. But we will rejoice when you become human and accept the conditions of fraternity and peace. And that's the proper object of warfare, to defend what must be defended so that it can be preserved for humanity, to preserve the dignity of the lives of our people, the purpose of our culture. But it is not to conquer, destroy like a beast trying to destroy another beast. We do not eat man. The purpose is to bring the human race together as a community of sovereign nation states, each perfectly sovereign, but united by an understanding of certain common principles by which we can live together, but not only merely live together, not merely get along and not kill, but live together in the sense that we are busy living our lives, making a contribution which is not shameful in the eyes of those who came before us. We're contributing something to the future. And therefore, when you are future-oriented in that way, you have a source of courage which no other human being has, who lacks that sense of the future. Now let's look at something awful. Let's look just briefly at a glimpse of what's going on in Israel and Palestine today. What we have is a shot I saw earlier, a shot of what is happening in Palestine and Israel now. And let me speak very frankly, because these are frank times. People are being killed. And you don't use soft words to describe hard reality. A long time ago, in Russia, there was a bad man. His name was Colonel Zubatov. He was the head of a secret police organization, which was disbanded essentially in that form after 1905. But it was called the Okhrana. What we have is, as I said, this fellow Zubatov recruited an individual called Vladimir Jabotinsky. Jabotinsky became an agent of the Okhrana, which was a British intelligence-affiliated Russian intelligence organization at the time, a police state. The main target of the Okhrana at that time were the Jews of Russia. Now, the leading organization among the Jews of Eastern Europe, or Russia in particular, was called the Bund, which was based in northern parts of then what was called Russia. It's known in the United States as the Workmen's Circle Organization. These people represented a formation called the Yiddish Renaissance, which was an extension among Jews of Eastern Europe of the tradition of Moses Mendelssohn, of the German Jewish tradition of Moses Mendelssohn. and modern European Jewry, and his all his achievements, and there were many, were actually largely a result of a revolution in the status of the Jew, effected through the influence of Moses Mendelssohn, one of the greatest intellectual figures of the 18th century. It was through Moses Mendelssohn and his family and friends that Jews were first allowed to be treated as human beings in Austria. This was by Joseph II of Austria, the emperor. And the similar status of the Jew was finally, the Jew was elevated to a condition in Germany of full dignity. And from that point on, under the influence of Moses Mendelssohn's program, we had some of the greatest music ever composed, because Mozart, Beethoven, other great composers, the circles of the Bach family, were all part of this same tradition, this so-called classical tradition, which was linked to this Jewish circle of Moses Mendelssohn. For example, Schubert, some of the songs of the Schubert of the Jewish service were composed with the aid of Franz Schubert. Mozart was closely allied with the Mendelssohn family. Beethoven was subsidized in part by Itzisch from Leipzig, a part of the extended Mendelssohn family. The great contribution of Jewish, German Jewish physicians, scientists, and others, like Heinrich Heine and others, to the culture of Europe as well, and civilization as a whole, as well as Germany, came from these people. And we had in Eastern Europe what was called the Yiddish Renaissance, the same tradition with a famous name like Sholem Aleichem, famous in the United States in particular. Many of the people who came here who were Jews from Europe, came from Germany originally, and later came in great numbers from the Yiddish Renaissance masses of Europe. Even into the 1960s, in the mobilization around Martin Luther King for civil rights in the United States, the Jewish unit, the Jewish element in the fight for civil rights of African Americans came largely from the legacy of the Yiddish Renaissance, of the immigrants of the Yiddish Renaissance into the United States. So this is a great tradition against which Volkano was fighting, Zubatov was fighting, and for which Jabotinsky was an agent. Jabotinsky then, as an agent, went to Paris, where he worked for one of the worst Okhrana agents in the world, the fellow who published and wrote and published the so-called Protocols of the Elders of Zion. He then became involved, among other things, in a British intelligence operation called Young Turk in Turkey. He was the publisher of the magazine, the official magazine of the Young Turk movement. He went to Italy, where he became a close associate of Benito Mussolini, declared himself a fascist, like Mussolini. His organization in Italy became an integral part of the fascist military organization in Italy. When Hitler was first elected to office, or nominated to office in Germany, he offered to support Hitler if Hitler would drop the anti-Semitism. This guy, Jabotinsky, the Jabotinsky movement, is a fascist movement. This movement went along with others into Israel, the settlements in Israel, and became the terrorist wing of Israel, which you associate with this terrorist, Menachem Begin, for example. Remember Menachem Begin, the fellow who bombed the King David Hotel, and there was the governor, the British governor of this region of this area, was sitting up in his bathtub, and they bombed the hotel. The hotel did not fall down completely, but there's this fellow sitting up in his bathtub with the building fallen down around him. So these guys were really killers. What happened is, in the course of developments from about 1967 through about 10 years later, the traditional Zionists, like Malcolm Goldman, the founder of Zionism, that type, these types were pushed out of the dominant position of power. And a group called the Likud, which incorporated the ideas and aspirations and moods of these fascists, declared fascists, became more and more a power in Israel. Ariel Sharon represents that fascist movement. What you're seeing, or what you could have seen on the screen, is a copy of an operation which the Nazis of Germany ran against the Jewish ghetto of Warsaw in 1943, which is now being conducted by the fascist Sharon against the Jewish ghettos, or these Palestinian ghettos of the Middle East, Israel and Palestine. And people are saying, If you're against Sharon, you're an anti-Semite. These people are liars. They are moral degenerates. It's not forgivable. For someone who says, I'm Jewish, I'm fighting for the Jewish people, to do what the Jabotinsky movement did as an avowed fascist movement, a Jabotinsky who was turned down by Hitler because Hitler wouldn't give up the anti-Semitism, and to perpetrate a crime which the Israeli Defense Forces know is an actual copy of the operation which the Nazis ran against the Jewish ghetto of Warsaw, against the Palestinian people. This is a crime against humanity. This is genocide. And when someone says, if you call this genocide, you're an anti-Semite, they're sick. But the problem here is this. How many people in the United States, for example, will defend Sharon, will defend what the Israelis are doing, while other Israelis are risking their lives opposing this, saying this is wrong? Remember, this is the Sharon government came to power indirectly through the terrorist assassination of Prime Minister Rabin of Israel, who recognized that this kind of thing must not happen. You have a terrorist government, a government that came to power through terrorism, the murder of a Prime Minister of Israel, and the crime has never been exculpated. You have, in effect, a criminal fascist government in charge in Israel, period. Don't talk about democracy. The president is misinformed. He should send Condoleezza Rice back to school to learn something, get some better advice. So this is the kind of problem we face. But worse is that not only are people in the United States expressing mass sympathy for this thing, the Pat Robertson, the Falwells, and so forth, who are implicitly fascist themselves, and many Americans have fallen for it. Worse than that, we have a military policy which is wrong. We don't have a strategic defense policy. We don't have an economy which is geared up to provide the sinews of strategic defense. We do not have a peace policy for the world. We, if I were president of the United States today, we would be bringing the world together. And it would be successful because the world wants it. The United States still has an authority and a legacy. If it became itself once again and said, we must have a solution to this worldwide financial economic crisis, we must have peace and cooperation on this planet, nations all over the world, peoples all over the world would rejoice and join us. We have that kind of power. So why aren't we using it? Now we'll come to the final point. What's the situation? Just go through this. I've gone through it before again, but it's important to put what I'm about to say in this context I've just given you. I think he's got the triple curves ready to go. This was the nature of the problem. We have a system now, since 1966, a degeneration in the U.S. economy, a degeneration from what used to be the world's greatest producer society into a decaying, decadent consumer society. We don't produce anymore, or we produce less and less. We import from abroad, and we can't afford to pay for it. And we're able to import less and less now. So what kind of a system do we have? We have where the financial aggregates, that is the rate of growth of stock market assets and similar kinds of nominal assets, paper assets, were rising at a very high rate. In order to make this, to keep this market going, there was a monetary emission, that is printing of money or similar things from the Federal Reserve and other, which was being poured into the markets to push this bubble of financial paper. But while they were doing that, the way this thing was being done is the growth of financial aggregates and monetary aggregates was based on looting, actually cannibalizing our pre-existing economy, so that per capita, the real physical output of the United States per capita was collapsing. Farms, so industries, so forth. Runaway shops, all this sort of thing. Now that's the picture. I'll take the next one. Now in this case, this is a point reached in about the year 2000. And what this represents is that you had a point at which the rate of increase of money printing required to maintain the financial markets was greater in amount than the amount of financial aggregate they were saving. At this point, there was an acceleration, a steep acceleration in collapse of the physical economy. Now, this happened about the summer of the year 2000, in real terms. And people didn't pay much attention or didn't wish to pay much attention because the financial aggregates were still going up. Until the full impact of the collapse of the so-called new economy occurred, people didn't pay much attention to it. But that happened then. Now let's go to the next third curve. And these are actual figures, or based on actual government figures. So what you see here is the crossover point. You see, what the employment is down, manufacturing employment, that's real employment. Farmers would show a more disastrous effect. Corporate profits fluctuating. The debt rising, level rising, but the U.S. money supply is being increased more rapidly than the financial markets are rising. So at that point, you've hit a point which has historical precedent, a very important one. Germany, 1923. Germany was doing the similar kind of thing then to pump up the Reichsmark while it was trying to pay off the so-called war reparations debt. Up until the spring of 1923, there was inflation, but not a chaotic or hyperinflationary bubble. Suddenly, in June, July of 1923, the bubble exploded.
You've been listening to EIR Talk's presentation of Lyndon LaRouche's international webcast of May 28, 2002. To hear a rebroadcast or to read a transcript, go to www.larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. EIR Talks will return in a moment with closing announcements.